Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Hacking the Electorate, How Campaigns Perceive Voters. The author of the book is Eitan Hirsch. The book is published by Cambridge University Press this year. I really hope that you enjoy the interview that I did today with Eitan. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to talk to the author of Hacking the Electorate, How Campaigns Perceive Voters. Eitan Hirsch, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have read the book. It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been looking forward to talking. At APSA this year, a couple of people said, when are you going to have Eitan Hirsch on to talk about his book? And so I said, this is something that I'll put on my fall calendar, and it's been great to be able to set this up. So let's talk about your very interesting book. But before we do, let's talk a little bit more about yourself. So who are you? Where are you now? Maybe you could just give us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm now starting my fifth year on the faculty at Yale in New Haven. I came from Harvard, where I did my graduate work. And what else can I tell you? I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, so I haven't ventured too far out of New England. And I'm glad to be here talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you on. Let's get to the book. And, you know, it occurred to me in reading this that there's been a lot written about get out the vote and voter contact. We had just, I guess it was 2 years ago, Lisa Garcia Bedolla on the podcast when her book with Michelle Michelson came out. And they were writing about the effectiveness of voter targeting. Your focus is different in this book. It's at the elite level of GOTV. I wonder if we could just start by, you know, kind of big picture. Why is it important to understand things from this vantage point?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of the work done on campaign strategy, when you think about things like, door-to-door canvassing and phone calls and direct mail, political scientists have studied those things a lot. But what they've really focused on is the effectiveness of those things, what works, what doesn't work. In the same way, a campaign might want to itself know, you know, what strategies are effective. But as a political scientist, you know, my main interest is not in, you know, helping any campaign, but understanding how parties and campaigns establish relationships with voters, how they mobilize, how they engage with the electorate. And for those kinds of questions, it's, you know, the interesting question is not how effective some strategy is, but what strategies are campaigns actually doing? What exactly are they doing? Why are they doing it? And you mentioned it's an elite level argument, and that's true in so much as the organizations, obviously, that engage with the electorate are real organizations. They're large infrastructures, like, you know, presidential campaigns. They have thousands of employees. They have big networks of state parties, and of course you have the national parties, and you have a lot of coordination among different groups. As I talk about in the book, you have a lot of shared data resources and shared strategies. And so I think it's important for us to understand what the strategy is, right? Not how effective it is, but what is it? What are these folks doing?
Now, you write in the book that you quote, you look under the hood of campaign databases in order to write the book. So in real practical terms, what did this mean for how you wrote the book? And in maybe describing that, you can talk a little bit about who you partnered with to write the book.
Sure. So, you know, if you imagine a journalist going to a campaign manager or a campaign data strategist or something like this and asking about what they do, you know, they might tell the reporter, oh, you know, here's what we do. We use the data to do this. But one of the nice things about being a political scientist who engages with data all the time is that I could ask the same questions and then say, hey, actually, can you just show me your data? Can you just show me what you're doing? And I'd like to see it. And over time, while I was writing this book, started in graduate school as a dissertation and continuing the book, I developed relationships with individuals, data scientists who work for campaigns, and with organizations, a big data firm called Catalyst, which a lot of political scientists now know about, with Democratic Party, with a company called NGP Van. And through these partnerships, I was able to see voters the way that campaigns see voters. And that's kind of what I mean by under the hood. We have an image of voters that we might get from political science surveys. or from, you know, information like from the census. But campaigns have their own way of viewing voters. And what I wanted to see in studying strategy was, how do campaigns think about voters? How do they see them? The subtitle of the book is How Campaigns Perceive Voters, right? Because some of the most interesting lessons about campaign strategy that I've learned in writing the book is about the sort of odd way that campaigns do look at voters. They see voters differently than we see voters by, say, looking in a public opinion survey.
Now, one of the research strategies you use in the book is to take advantage of the interstate differences in laws regarding the collection of public information that campaigns can use to target voters. So first, how are these laws different? And second, how does this open an analytical method for your research?
Sure. So, right, when looking at the campaign databases, one thing that becomes immediately apparent and really important is that public records play a really central role in campaigns' perceptions of voters, right? We don't have survey responses for every voter in the electorate. What campaigns have is a compilation of public records, and those public records vary across state. So that's kind of what makes this book as much a book about public policy as about campaign strategy, because what the story is really here is that state governments and the federal government make laws about data collection, and those laws have very real and important consequences for how campaigns mobilize voters. So states vary, for example, in the kinds of data they collect on the voter registration system. Some states ask voters to register with a party affiliation. Some states, when a voter participates in a primary, the state records whether that primary was a Democratic primary or Republican one. Some states list voters, require voters to list their race when they register to vote. And so there's a whole separate story about why those laws exist to begin with. But from the campaign's perspective, they're kind of handed a voter file, and some of those voter files have, you know, race on the voter file for every voter, and some don't. And so one strategy I used to kind of understand, to show how strategies and outcomes are affected by the ways campaigns perceive voters in their own databases, was to say, okay, well, let's take two states like North Carolina and Virginia, both swing states in 2012. One state, North Carolina, every voter is listed with their race. The other state, Virginia, no voters are listed with their race. And let's see how a campaign like the Obama campaign, who is engaging voters in both those states, how they pursue a different strategy, whether the state provides them with race or not. And so, you know, what I show in the book in that particular case is that, you know, the Obama campaign, for example, was really engaged in both those states, but they engaged with a really different kind of voter in Virginia and in North Carolina. In North Carolina, first of all, they focused a lot more on race than they did in Virginia. And they did that because they could. They had information about every voter's race. The other thing they did is that they focused more on individuals and less on geography. So in Virginia, where voters are not listed by their race, they focused mostly on African-American voters who live in homogenous black neighborhoods. In North Carolina, they didn't have to do that because they had, for every individual voter, no matter where they lived, a good indicator of their race. So, you know, that's the sense in which a policy about, you know, in this case, voter registration data collection could affect a strategy and indeed affect which voters actually show up to the polls. And, you know, that's just one example. I mean, states vary in the information that you can FOIA from the state agencies about, for example, which voters have teaching licenses or hunting licenses or physician's licenses. All of the public records, they vary by geography, by jurisdiction. And what I tried to do is exploit those variations to understand from the campaign's perspective how these variations affect how campaigns see the electorate and therefore what they do. And, you know, I think to the end of your question, you know, as it's easier for us political scientists to leverage public records, individual level records that have never been used before, we can find these kinds of new opportunities to look at how the public records vary across the country and in different places and at different times to understand their effects on elite or mass behavior.
Now, we all probably know something about redistricting, and redistricting is not done in a random fashion. It's done in a very purposeful fashion. Is the laws that oversee this public information collection simply random? Is it something that just it just so happens that North Carolina collects race data and Virginia doesn't, or is there a larger story to be told about the purpose of this for those making policy or the political parties that have influence over those decisions?
Okay, that's a great question. There are two answers. There are two ways I think about this. One answer, which I talk a lot about in the book, is that states sometimes pass data laws because they have political ramifications. In other words, a state might seek to collect certain data about voters because not because there's an administrative need to collect that data, but because there's a political need. So I go through some examples of states passing laws about the collection of race data or the collection of partisanship data from voters, in which I've uncovered evidence that state legislators in proposing these laws had in mind a political rationale. In other words, there's in some cases no reason why a state needs to collect race data or collect party affiliation data. And yet state legislators were saying, you know, we should collect these data because they're good for our campaign databases. They're good for the political parties trying to engage the electorate. So that's, I think, a pretty interesting story about why some states have data while other states don't. The other, like, more boring, I guess, answer is that, you know, some states, for example, with the partisanship data, some states have open primaries versus closed primaries. And so if you have a closed primary, meaning if you need to restrict participation in primary elections to party affiliates, then the state has a reason to want to collect party information from voters. So some of this comes from sensible administrative policy, although, you know, the states really can take different views about you could separate out the decision to collect certain information from a state and the rationale for distributing that information to political parties. One thing that I thought was pretty interesting is that there have been a number of attempts, mostly by libertarian type Republicans, to enable voters to register to vote without having their information transferred to the political parties. In other words, a Republican legislator passed a law saying, you know, you should be able to participate in elections without your information being, you know, handed off to all the political organizations that want to contact you. The mainstream party affiliates in the state legislatures have prevented those laws from going into effect because, you know, they see the political benefits of data collection. In making this argument, I don't want to make the case necessarily that the data being collected for the purposes of helping parties is necessarily a bad thing. The parties face a daunting task in needing to recruit voters and trying to figure out who their supporters might be, and data helps. But I think the interesting normative question, the interesting ethical question, is how much the public should be subsidizing the information gathering process of the political parties by having the government collect lots of data that really isn't done in service to the political parties.
Now, for much of the book, and you develop this theory that you describe as the perceived voter model theory, and you're very specific about being focused on the perception of voters, not actual voters. So do campaigns accurately perceive voters? Do campaigns possess reliable voter data when it comes down to it?
You know, it really depends on the kind of voter data. When you think about something like, do they accurately perceive a voter's age and gender? They do, because it's not that hard to figure that out. Age is almost always a public record in these states, and gender, even when it's not a public record, is pretty easy to decipher from someone's name. So, you know, if a campaign comes to me and to my door, they probably will likely know my gender and my age. They'll perceive that accurately. But, you know, for a lot of things that campaigns care about, their perceptions are really inaccurate. Now, it happens that sometimes our own perceptions of ourselves are pretty inaccurate, too. So you think, for example, of what it means to be persuadable. So you imagine what we have in mind, we think about a persuadable voter is someone who could legitimately change their opinion about a candidate or an issue given a treatment, given that a campaign engages with that voter and tries to persuade them, convince them, that voter might actually move their opinion. Now, it's difficult for voters to make a self-assessment of that. As we know, a lot of people who, for example, identify as independents are really not independent. And a voter who thinks of themselves as persuadable might not actually be persuadable. Voters have their own perceptions. And then we have some objective perceptions, objective measures we might think of what it means to be persuadable or treatment responsive to a persuasion message. And then we have what campaigns have, which is almost no information that alerts them to which voters are persuadable. So you can think of a whole number of characteristics, and especially it's the characteristics that have about a voter's opinion or a voter's psychological state, about which campaigns have very, very poor perceptions of voters. And that's not because the campaigns are bad at what they do. It's because it's a really hard thing to do, to figure out which voter might be persuadable or to figure out which voter might take this position on a particular issue when there's nothing really in the public record or in commercial databases that alert the campaign to that issue position.
Now, you offer some policy recommendations towards the end of the book, without having to go into each one of them. What are you recommending? What are some of the primary recommendations that you come to?
So I would say that the overarching theme of the book's conclusion is that is to alert the reader and to alert interested parties that there is this really important connection between public policy about data and what campaigns are doing. That, you know, we have to get rid of this image of campaigns being these highly sophisticated organizations that do top secret stuff and have all sorts of data. Well, what they really have is compilations of public records and then models built off those public records. And as I show in the book, changes in policy, differences across states over time about what information is collected really does affect how political parties and campaigns engage with the electorate. And so just in terms of the overarching theme of the policy recommendations, it's that, A, we need to be aware of those policy changes. And so when state legislatures pass laws or amendments to their FOIA law or amendments to their voter registration laws, we kind of have to raise a bit of a red flag for observers saying, maybe this data law is going to have ramifications in the political world that we weren't previously thinking about. And more specifically, I want to point out that there is often a conflict of interest, that there might be an administrative rationale for collecting some data from the public, and there's also a political benefit for collecting that data. And, you know, sometimes politicians have too much of the political incentive in mind. And so I give a couple of policy recommendations to decouple the political and administrative incentive for public data collection.
The book is Hacking the Electorate, How Campaigns Perceive Voters, published this year by Cambridge University Press. The author is Eitan Hirsch. Eitan, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.